Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Tom Richardson, 47 years of combination experience, retired chief of department with the FDNY back in 2023. At a very young age, Tom was surrounded by the fire service, starting with his father, who was a volunteer. After joining that same volunteer department as his father and a few ride-alongs with neighbors who were with the FDNY, it was inevitable for Tom to find his passion. Upon entering the FDNY, Tom was surrounded by senior men who were not on the job, but into it. And within the interview, Tom explains why we all should be. I truly hope the listeners can gain a little bit of knowledge from what Tom speaks. With that, I present Mr. Tom Richardson.
Hello, everyone. My name's Tom Richardson. I'm retired chief of department for the FDNY, and I've been in the fire service a very, very long time. It started for me when I was, I joined the fire department in my local town, the Deer Park Volunteer Fire Department, in 1978. My dad was a member of the fire department. My dad had joined the fire department in 1968 at the age of 35 years old. He's a former Marine, Korean War Marine, and he felt that he wanted to give back to the community where we lived in Deer Park, Long Island. My dad worked for Con Edison, a utility company in New York City. He was a lineman, and then he joined the fire department at 35 years old, and he loved it. He loved every minute of it. So when he joined the fire department, I was 9 years old, and I was the oldest of five children. And I just watched my dad over the years, how much he loved it. And when I was probably a teenager of about maybe 15, 16 years old, I really started to take an interest, and I used to go to the firehouse with my dad. Before that, my youngest brother was really always with my dad at the firehouse, and ironically, he never became a firefighter. I was the only one. I have two brothers, and I was the only one who became a firefighter. But I started hanging around Deer Park with my dad. He wound up going up through the ranks and became a chief in Deer Park, and he was very, very much into training. He loved training. He was passionate about it, and he was a good firefighter. His dad, my grandfather, who I never met, he died before I was born, was a New York City firefighter. And my dad joined the fire department, and he got into training. And there were a couple of New York City firefighters that had joined the Deer Park Fire Department. One guy's name was John Vigiano. You may know the name. Many of you may know the name. John retired as a captain in the FDNY, and his two sons were killed on 9/11. One was a police officer, and one was a firefighter. They both died on 9/11. That was his only two children. But John joined the volunteer fire department in like 1976-ish in that neighborhood, and him and my dad hit it off because John was a Marine. My father was a Marine. And then there was another gentleman, his name was Larry Canillo. Larry just passed away about a year ago. Larry was from Engine Company 82 in the Bronx, South Bronx. And he was there during the heyday when they were very, very busy. Everybody that's into the fire service, and if you've ever done any reading, the report from Engine Company 82, Dennis Smith, well, this guy Larry Canillo was in 82 Engine at the time, you know, when Dennis wrote the book. So anyway, those two guys joined the fire department, and they got involved with the training with my dad. They helped them out. And I met them as a young kid, 16. And I remember, Vigiano said to me, he was a lieutenant Rescue 2 in Brooklyn at the time, very busy rescue company. And he said, hey, you want to come to work with me? I said, sure. So I went to ride with him a few times in rescue. And back in those days, they were pretty busy. And I said, man, this is pretty cool. I think I might want to do this for a living, you know? And I had a neighbor across the street from me, right directly across the street. His name was Pete Iovino. Pete was a firefighter in Engine 236 in East New York, Brooklyn. And I went to ride with him a few times when I was a kid. And my neighbor next door was a retired New York City firefighter, old timer, Dave O'Neill. And he worked in Engine 236 when he was on the job. So I was kind of surrounded by it. So when I got out of high school, I was 17 and I turned 18 shortly thereafter. There was a test for the New York City Fire Department coming up in December of 1977. So I filed for the test, took the test, did pretty well. And then I joined the Deer Park Fire Department in January of 78 when I was 18 years old. I turned 18 in October of 77. So I joined Deer Park. I became a volunteer and I was just waiting to get called by New York City. And I did pretty well on a test. At that time, you took a written test and a physical agility test, and they combined your scores and you came up with a final score. And I had a pretty good list number, but I wasn't old enough. You have to be 21 years old to be hired. So they passed my number several times. So as luck would have it, and I always told people I was living the dream, I turned 21 years old on October 9th, 1980, and I got sworn as New York City firefighter on November 20th, 1980. And our official date was 11/22/80, November 22nd. We were sworn in on the 20th. It took effect on the 22nd. So 100 firefighters, 100 young men in the class. 77 out of the 100 were 21 years old. We were all waiting. And then my career just took off from there. So that's how I got involved. I got involved because my dad was in it. My grandfather was a New York City firefighter. And I really saw the passion that my dad had for it. He loved it. He really, really loved it. And I always used to say to him, "Why didn't you become a firefighter, New York City firefighter? You would have been great at it." And, he got out of Marine Corps, met my mom, they got married, he got the job at Con Edison. And then eventually I was born a couple of years later. They move out to Long Island, they buy a house, and he said, I couldn't take the pay cut. He says back then, he said it was 1962 when they moved out to Long Island. And that was a time when New York City was hiring a lot of firefighters. Guys like Vigiano and people like that, Ray Downey, those guys all got hired in early like 1962. I think Larry Canillo, the guy I mentioned before, he got on the job in like 68 or 69 or 70, one of those years, right around there. So I was surrounded by it, and I just, as a young teenager, I decided this is what I wanted to do with my life.
Okay. And so upon getting that call and going through the process, what was it like upon stepping foot, into the FDNY?
I'm telling you, it really was a dream come true because I had been in the volunteers about 3 years prior to getting called for New York City. So I learned a little bit. I went to a few fires. It was pretty cool. I went to a few fires with my dad. It was cool.
Okay.
And so I had a little taste, and I was like, oh man, I can't wait to do this for a living. I want to do this every day. And when I went to the fire academy back then, it was 6 weeks of training. They were hiring. They hadn't hired a class in a year from the year when I got hired. The last class they hired was a year earlier. If many people remember, it was 1977 they gave the test. In 1980, I think it was, is when the women filed a lawsuit. And so there was a hiring freeze from like November 79 to November of 80. There was no classes. And then the women eventually won their lawsuit and 40 ladies came on the job in 1982. But my probie school was 6 weeks, and it was 6 weeks for quite some time. And then over the years, it's increased. It's now 18 weeks. I have a nephew in the fire academy right now, my brother's oldest son. And my son, I'm hoping, is going to be in the next class, in January, we're hoping. So it looks pretty good. So, just being on the fire academy grounds when I first got there the first day, I was a kid from Long Island. I wasn't in the military. And it was, paramilitary. It was tough. We did physical fitness. It was the winter, so it was a little cold, when we started. I got in late November, so it was still the fall, but then it got into the winter. And I graduated the probie school in, I think, early January of 1981. And I got assigned to my firehouse thereafter. But it was a dream come true because that's really what I wanted to do with my life.
Okay. And your first assignment, what was it?
So I was assigned to an engine company 227. It was a single engine company in Brownsville, Brooklyn. Busy busy engine company. And my first captain, his name was Ed Higgins. He was a senior guy, a senior officer. He was the captain of Engine 227. He was a lieutenant in Engine 227 prior to that. Tremendous amount of experience. It was literally like working with my dad. He was around my father's age, maybe a little older, but we had a whole bunch of young guys in our company, all young men, and then there were some senior guys. So being assigned to that company was something that I'll never forget. It really molded me for the rest of my career. I think I learned the right way from the people I worked with there, who were all tremendous individuals. And we went to our share of fires, and the officers there, Captain Higgins, and there were other officers, a guy named Eddie Sweeney, Frank Heller, Ronnie Meehan. These guys were all stars, and they taught us right, and they demanded, excellence. They demanded operational discipline. And in an engine company, they said, you got to do your position. If you don't do your position, we don't succeed. So I had a very good experience there. And I was there, I worked there for about 4.5 years, and then I transferred to a ladder company.
Okay. With that being said, how did you enjoy the ladder company side?
So I went to a ladder company 102. That was in like Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn.
Okay.
And again, it was a recommendation from John Vigiano to go there. A guy by the name of Dennis Cross was the captain of Ladder 102. And again, the cast of officers in that firehouse were just class A. These guys were tremendous officers with a lot of experience. Dennis Cross, one of the best fire officers I ever worked with. And unfortunately, he was killed on 9/11. He was a battalion chief. He was an acting deputy chief that day, and he responded, and he was killed when the South Tower collapsed. But I was only there for 2.5 years, and I really wish I could have spent a couple of more years in the ladder company and learned a little bit more, but I had an opportunity that came upon me, after 2.5 years in Ladder 102, and I wound up being able to go to Rescue 2 as a firefighter. Now, John Vigiano was still a lieutenant there at the time. This is
Okay.
1987. He'd been there a long time. And he said, we want kids with heart and desire. We want young people that are learning the job. And so I went to Rescue 2 in August of 1987, initially on a detail, and eventually I was assigned there officially. And I only spent 3 years there. But again, Ray Downey was the captain. I'm sure a lot of people that are going to be listening heard of Ray Downey, captain of Rescue 2. John Vigiano was a lieutenant. Another fellow, Artie Connolly, was a lieutenant there. A guy named Craig Shelley was a lieutenant there at the time, covering through. Then we got a guy named, remember, a lot of people know John Norman. John Norman's written a lot of books. John Norman became a lieutenant. So I worked with unbelievably talented officers throughout my firefighter career, and all the firefighters I worked with that I learned from. I literally stood on their shoulders. These guys were tremendous individuals, just good human beings, excellent firefighters, excellent teachers. When I went to Rescue 2, I walked in that firehouse and I was very, very intimidated. I only had coming up on 7 years on the job. I didn't feel like I had enough experience, but I had the opportunity. Rescue 2 lost five guys to promotion on a lieutenant's exam. They promoted a bunch of lieutenants on the first day of the list, and five guys from Rescue 2 got promoted. So Captain Downey was looking for people. So I went there with four other guys. I went there with Eddie Higgins's son, one of his sons that was on the job, Timmy Higgins. I went with a guy, Billy Lake, a guy, Mike Esposito, and a guy, Kevin Dowdell. The four of those guys, all four of them were killed on 9/11. They were all, three of them were officers in other companies, and Billy Lake was working in Rescue 2. But I went there in August of 87. Within a few weeks of each other, we all went and got assigned there. Again, just tremendous individuals. Four of them got promoted, Mike Esposito, Timmy Higgins, Kevin Dowdell, three of them, they got promoted to lieutenant. Kevin was working in Rescue 4. Mike Esposito was in Squad 1. and Timmy was in squad 252. But Captain Higgins had four sons on the job. Four sons on the job. Timmy became a lieutenant. His brother Rob, Bob was a I think he retired as a captain. Mike was in 108 truck, and Joe was a firefighter in Engine 217 in Brooklyn. But I knew them all. The father, all four boys came on the job, and then I think he had one son became a cop. I think it was.
Okay.
But tremendous individuals all throughout my firefighter career really prepared me to be an officer, especially my time in rescue. Being able to go to as many fires as we did and working with those individuals, I felt pretty comfortable when I got promoted to lieutenant in 1990. I had about 10 years on the job at the time.
Okay. So I have two questions. The first question for you is, how important and what advice would you give to other individuals out there to do what you do, to do what you did, meaning you surrounded yourself with individuals that were into the job to obtain knowledge and information? So how important is that for newer firefighters coming in to do?
So I know one of your main themes is essentially being a student of the job, right? Being a student of the business, right? So when you what I tell young men and women when they come in this job, from the time you come on the job, you have to be into the job, not just on the job. You got to be into the job. And I think that goes for any profession where you want to be good at it, right? Just like professional sports, you got to be into it, man. You got to want it. John Vigiano used to tell me all the time, one of his famous lines that I always remember was, "You give me a young person with heart and desire, and I will make them a firefighter, as long as they are into the job." So, what I tell young people today, and I've told my son, and my son's getting prepared to hopefully come in the next class, I already gave him a set of books and I said, "Start reading. Start reading. Start reading the basics. Understand the basics. Know the fundamentals of firefighting. Know the basics. Just like professional sports, or if you played little league or high school ball, the fundamentals. You got to have the basics. You got to have a good foundation. So from the day you come in the job, start to read. When you go to a firehouse, when you get out of the fire academy, I tell them, when you run the house watch for 3 hours, when you have the watch, read something. Read one bulletin a tour. Read something every tour related to your job. And do that for your entire career. When the time comes when you make a decision or not to study for promotion, you'll have that foundation. You'll have that base to build on. And even if you don't want to be an officer and you don't study for promotion, you want to just stay as a firefighter, which is fine. It'll make you a better firefighter. It'll make you, and even when you get promoted, I tell people, read every day. When I was a chief in the field, I read something every tour. I wanted to stay on my game. And it's hard sometimes, especially when you're not doing a lot of work. Maybe it's a slow period of time. You haven't gone to a fire in a few months. You lose the edge. You're rusty. I found that myself when I was an officer and a chief. You got to stay on your game. So being a student of the job is so important, and being into the job and asking questions. Don't ever, I always tell people, don't ever be afraid to ask a question to a senior firefighter or an officer. If you don't know, ask. And you're going to learn. You literally do learn. It's trial by fire, literally, sometimes, right? As you know. And it's difficult, but we learn from our mistakes, but always ask questions, always self-critique, and sometimes we're hard on ourselves, right? We're hard on each other at times. This is a tough business. The firehouse kitchen can be rough, when things don't go well. So it's all about the team. It's all about being into the job. It's all about having a mindset that you want to be the best firefighter, best fire officer, best chief officer you could possibly be. And the only way you do that is you stay into it, man. Like today, what I tell young people too, there are more resources today between all the things online, firefighterclosecalls.com. Billy Goldfeder does an unbelievable job with that. There's so much firehouse.com, fire engineering. There's so much information available and to get different perspectives from people from all over the country. I think as a young firefighter today, you can never go wrong just expanding your wealth, your breadth of knowledge, I should say.
Definitely. Definitely. Okay. Love the advice. And the second part of my question was, you stated you waited 10 years to get promoted. As I always like to ask the guests when it comes to promotion, what I would call tripped your breaker to go, okay, I think I'm ready for the next step. And why did you do that?
So I think you probably would agree, and I think most firefighters would agree, in our business, whether we like to admit it or not, there's a little bit of peer pressure, if you will, on certain things. So I wouldn't call it wasn't really peer pressure on me, but when I was in Ladder 102, everybody was studying. We had a double house and a chief. We had Engine 209, Ladder 102, and the 3-4 Battalion. Most of the guys in the truck were studying, and a bunch of guys in the engine were studying. It was just that was what was going on. We would be on the rig throwing questions back and forth at each other. We were going to school, promotional course that the fire department, you could take advantage of. Everybody was studying. So I said, wow, at the least, I'm going to be a better firefighter for doing this. And if I do okay on the exam, I'll be happy. So it was like I saw senior firefighters studying, I saw younger firefighters studying. When I took the test for lieutenant, I had 6 years on the job, but I had been studying for a year and a half to 2 years, maybe altogether, because that's what you do. It's a the promotional process in New York City is very, very competitive. We have upwards of 22,000, 2,500 people, maybe more sometimes, take a lieutenant's exam. And over the course of a 4-year list, they might promote 800 to 1,000, maybe a few more sometimes. So it's very, very competitive. So I took the lieutenant's test in June of 86, and the test wound up getting thrown out. There was all kinds of controversy. So we had to retake the test in December of 1986. And I did much better in June. And in December, I made the list. I got on the list. And I got promoted. The list came out in 87, like September, August of maybe, yeah, August of 87, because that's when a bunch of guys from rescue got promoted, and I wound up going there. And I got promoted in 1990, and almost 3 years to the day, I went to rescue on a detail. So, August of 1990, I got promoted to lieutenant. But the motivating factor was just being around people that were studying, and having a desire to just be a better firefighter.
And with you being on the engine, the ladder, and the rescue, a personal question, what was your niche? Did you like engine work? Did you like ladder work? Did you like the rescue side?
That's a great point. So I kid around, and I tell people all the time, the best two positions in the fire department are nozzle and engine officer. Because you're right there every time, like you're there, right? But when you're in the truck, you got to be a thinker, man. You always got to be thinking when you got the different positions. Like in New York City, we have a lot of people. We have five firefighters on a ladder company. We got the can firefighter, the irons firefighter, we got the roof, the OV, the outside vent. You got to think going to get to your position. What kind of building is it? What's the tool assignment? A lot to think about. So that's why the studying and being into the job really matters, right? But in the engine, I wound up being an officer in a lieutenant in an engine company. I was the captain of an engine company and a squad company, which is essentially an engine and special operations. So I really enjoyed the engine work, but my time in the truck really rounded it out. I got to learn a little bit more. Like I said, I wish I could have spent a couple more years in the truck working with the folks that I did. And I think I would have learned a little more. But when I went to rescue, most of the work that the rescue company does at a fire, most of it was truck related. It was a lot of searches on the roof, so I was able to gain some experience doing that. But I really enjoyed the engine. I enjoyed it a lot, and I think it's and I kid around a lot, but I kind of tell guys, engine officer and nozzle firefighter, like the two best positions in the job, like, right? And doesn't get better, man, putting the fire out. Talk about being satisfied, feeling like, man, I did a great job. But being in the truck, being in the rescue, when you're doing searches and you make rescues, right? You find people, and that's not to say, I mean, I worked with plenty of engine officers that made beautiful, dramatic rescues, you know, when they got there first and the truck wasn't in yet and the engine officer had to make a decision. So, but when you save somebody's life, there's nothing better than that. And certainly when you put a fire out, it's a good feeling. You know, you feel like, hey man, I did my job, right? And you know, as you know, it doesn't always go 100%. You know, it's a very humbling business, my friend, right?
Absolutely.
We get humbled often. You know, whether you're a junior firefighter, a senior firefighter, senior chief officer, we become humbled very quickly sometimes.
And one of your many accolades, you were a part of a rescue back in '89, where you were lowered from the top floor of a three-story building to rescue a 15-year-old in a fire. If you can kind of describe and talk about that whole scenario, because you know that's one of those things firefighters want to get a save, want to make a grab. So can you explain to us what that was like?
Sure. So that's one of those situations too that I could be perfectly honest and say that didn't go 100% as it should have gone as planned. But as you know, the fire scene is very chaotic. It's full of friction and uncertainty, right? So I was working in rescue two that night, and I was assigned the roof position. And Captain Downey was working, and we were coming back from another job in East New York. We were going back to the firehouse, and we were almost back at the firehouse. We were actually right on the corner of my first firehouse, Engine 227. We were on the corner where that firehouse is, and we were going back to our quarters. And it was like 5 o'clock in the morning, and the dispatcher called, said, "Start out for such and such. Sounds like a job." And it wasn't far away. It was less than 2 miles. It was pretty close. So we were on our way quick. So when we pulled in the block, we got there pretty quickly. And it was a pretty good job in a building we call a brownstone. It was a three-story, you know, brick building. They have a high stoop. The main entrance to the building is actually on the second floor. And the first floor, you go under the stoop to go in. Well, the fire was on that, we call it the parlor floor. That was the second floor. It was a three-story building. And the fire's coming out the windows in the front of the building merrily. And I get off the apparatus. And the tool assignment is for the roof firefighter, one of the tools that you take at a brownstone fire is, we called it the roof rope then. It's really, now it's called the life-saving rope. I grabbed the rope, I grabbed my tools, and we all started going down the block. And as we were going down the block, I heard the outside vent firefighter, kid, a guy by the name of Bob Galeone, who eventually, he actually took my place in rescue when I got promoted. He was a ladder 176, excellent firefighter. He was in the rear yard and he was given a report that there were people at the windows on the top floor in the rear. So we came down the block. I remember I went up the aerial ladder to the roof. I guess it was 176's ladder. There was ladder 176 and the ladder 112 was the other truck. Anyway, went up to the roof with the rope and everything, and there was a roof firefighter from 176 up there. And you know, there was a lot of communication on the radio, of course. It was a pretty good fire. And I went to the back and I looked over, and sure enough, there was a woman at the window. And she was, you know, pretty excited, of course. And they were in a tough spot. They couldn't get down the stairs. So I proceeded to set up this rope rescue operation. And the guy from 176 helped me out. And I went over the edge of the roof. It didn't go as planned. It wasn't really perfect. I made a couple of mistakes, but it all worked out. Nobody got hurt. And when I got to the window, the woman was screaming. It was a big, pretty big woman. And she was screaming about a baby, you know. And I said, "Well, give me the baby." And well, the baby was the 15-year-old kid. The kid was like 6 foot tall. He was a big boy. He came crawling out the window, and I grabbed him, and they lowered me to the ground. And in fact, when I first got lowered, these guys did an unbelievable job on the roof. when I first got lowered to the window, I got lowered a little too far, and they had to actually pull me up a little bit. I don't know how he did it, but they did it, and I was able to grab the kid and bring him down. And he was, he was smoked up a little bit, but not terribly bad. Turned out the woman was in there, and there was an adult male in there as well, unconscious on the floor, which I didn't know. And the guys from Rescue 2, Captain Downey, this guy Larry Gray, they wound up getting to the folks from the interior, and they wound up bringing them out the interior. The one guy, he was burnt pretty good, I think. And I don't know, remember if he survived, but the kid survived, and it all worked out. In fact, when you do those rope rescues, you're really supposed to notify the incident commander that you're in the process. I couldn't get through on the radio because it was a lot of excitement. They knew people were trapped. Never got through on the radio, really. We just kind of did it. And I remember after the fire, Captain Downey coming up to me in the front of the building. He says, "Hey, did you do a rope rescue?" I says, "Yeah. We brought the kid down and everything." He was like, "We didn't even know." I said, "I couldn't get through all the radio. We're in the middle of doing it." It was kind of crazy, but it was a crazy time. But listen, we prepare for that. We
Right.
train a lot on that evolution. We
Right.
train a lot. New York City firefighters train on that all the time. And when the time comes to do it, you got to know what you're doing. And there were some mistakes were made on my part, on a couple other guys' part. It didn't go as well. I could have got hurt, put it that way. And it was on me, actually. If you're the guy going over on a rope, you got to make sure everything's squared away. And I didn't. I think I was just too excited. And I was probably in the moment, and I just did it, and it all worked out. But certainly didn't go as a 100% perfect evolution, And I used to tell that story all the time when I went around as a chief. I used to tell guys, if you get involved in a rope rescue, man, you got to be on your game. You got to make sure. And I got pretty lucky there that I didn't get hurt.
And one of the things that sparked a notion in my head, you mentioned the woman said, "My baby, my baby."
Yeah.
Most of us think, oh, an actual baby, but to
That's right.
her, it was her
That's right.
15-year-old son. So
That's right.
a baby could be very many different things to many different
That's
people.
right. And you've heard things when people pull up to house fires and people talking about their babies. Sometimes it's their animals, their
Right,
dogs or
right.
cats, right? And firefighters sometimes take these unnecessary risks, not knowing or unknowingly. So I learned that many years ago. So if people ever said that to me, I says, is it a child? But at that moment with that woman, I just said, "Give me the baby,"
You rose all the way, you went through the ranks and rose all the way to chief of department. So this is going to kind of go hand in hand. Did you ever see yourself getting to that point? And when you decided to become an officer, what kind of leader did you want to be with it?
So I, in my wildest dreams, never, I didn't aspire to be the chief of department. I never had that on my mind. I wanted to be a battalion chief. That was my goal when I started to study. I said, "You know what? If I can make battalion chief by the time I have about 20 years on the job, I think I will have achieved what I wanted to. I've accomplished, what I wanted to do." So I was a lieutenant for 3 years. I did pretty well on the captain's exam, got promoted to captain. I was a captain for almost 7 years. And then I got promoted battalion chief. And interestingly enough, I laugh, and we laugh all the time when we talk about it, the guys I got promoted with. I got promoted to battalion chief the last day of the list. The list was expiring, and they promoted a bunch of chiefs like 2 days before the list was expiring. And I didn't think I was getting promoted. The list kind of was moving along, and then it stopped, died. And I said, "Oh, I might not get made." There was a new chief's test coming up, but I was a captain in a squad company in the squad 270 in Queens. I had been there for about 2.5 years, or maybe 2 years, when the test came up, and I was really enjoying it. It was a great assignment. It was a new company, and I didn't take the test. I said to my wife, "You know what? I'll take the next one." I was still on the current list. I didn't think I was getting promoted. They called me a couple of days and before the promotion, said, "Listen, you're getting promoted on Friday." I'm like, "What?" This was like Wednesday. Yeah, we're promoting 32 chiefs. So we got promoted the last day of the list. So I make battalion chief, and I was coming up just, I think I had 19 years and 10 months, when I got promoted to battalion chief, and I wound up having a great run as a chief. I was a battalion chief for 14 years, and I took two deputy chief's exams, and I didn't really study hard for them, and I didn't, I failed. And then I was like, I had 34 years that when I took, when the next one was coming up, I think I had 33, almost 34 years in the job. And my friend, a lot of people know him too, because he's out and about now, Frank Lieb. You know Frank? You hear Frank?
Yes, sir.
Frank Wilson. Frank was one of my firefighters in Squad 270. Tremendous young man, super wizard, smart, and had a wonderful career. He and his study group was a bunch of younger guys. They decided to study for deputy chief. And he calls me up and says, "Why don't you get in our study group?" I'm like, "Frank, I'm done. I can't do it. I just don't." But it was actually a good time for me to study because my kids were older now. I have
Right.
three children. So I got into the study group. These guys were amazing, amazing study group, really smart, really sharp. And I kind of got into it. Like I said, I got into it because I was in a rut. I was a chief for a long time. And I was like, but I got into the books. I started studying pretty hard. I had the time to do it. And I wound up writing number one on the deputy chief's desk. So I got promoted the first day they made promotions. And I was only a deputy chief for about 2.5 years. And a friend of mine calls me. His name was Jim Hodgins. Jim was the chief of training. And they were looking for a new chief of the fire academy. And that's a staff position. So he said, "Would you, give it some thought?" And I was like, "I don't know, man. I'm only a deputy 2.5 years." I had gotten an assignment in my where I worked most of my career in Brooklyn. I was in the 15th Division, and I loved it. It was great. But then I said, "You know what? By that point, I have now I'm coming up on 37 years, and the job has been so good to me." I said, "You know what? I got to give back a little bit," and I called him back and I said, "I'll give it a shot," and I wound up going to the fire academy and being the chief of the fire academy for a little while. And then Jimmy decided to retire shortly thereafter, and I became the chief of training. Timing is everything on the fire department, right?
Right.
So I become the chief of training, and I'm the chief of training for like a year. And our chief of department was retiring, and the fire commissioner decides to interview four people for chief of department, and I'm now chief of training. So I was like, I get a call from his secretary, and she says, "Chief, I need to make an appointment for an interview." I said, "Interview for what?" She goes, "Well, the commission is interviewing people for chief of department." He says, "He's going to interview four people. You're one of them." I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "No way." I've only been on the staff, like, I think it was less than 2 years, honestly.
Okay.
Maybe a little more than two. Maybe it was a little more than two and a half. And I was like, "Wow, this is crazy." So, in the fire department, I never had an interview in my life because our promotional process is a written exam. That's it.
Okay.
So I went for the interview. I didn't get the chief of department job, but he asked me to become chief operations. So I'm like, "I like training, man. I'm really loving training. I've only been here a short while. We're making some progress. We're doing some things. I got great people. I loved it. I loved being in training. It was always my passion." But he said, "Listen, man, I really want you to do this. You got to do it." So it was really not, he wasn't asking, So
Right.
I was chief operations. I became the chief of operations. The chief of department was my friend John Sudnick. And I wound up being chief operations, I guess, for a little over 2 years. And then John Sudnick decided to retire in 2021, start the retirement process. So I was made acting chief of department. I think it was like March of 21. And then the commissioner decided to promote me to chief of department in June of 2021. I only stayed in the job until that January, the next January 2022, and then I started to take my leaves and stuff like that, right? So I would have stayed longer. When you get to those levels in the fire department, it's very political. Fire Commissioner Nigro was great to me. We had a new mayor elected. There was going to be a new fire commissioner, and I made a decision. You know, I had, like I said, at that point, over 41 years, and I decided to start making the retirement move, and it all worked out. I was blessed, but never did I. It was a long answer to a shorter question, but I never aspired to be chief of department, but I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I was proud. I was proud to be the chief of the FDNY in my wildest dreams. I wish my dad and my mom were alive to see it. My mom was alive when I got promoted to battalion chief. My father wasn't, but it was quite the run. I loved being chief of operations because chief of operations is really the job. You know, you're running the entire field operation. You know,
Okay.
you report to the chief of department who reports to the fire commissioner. But chief operations was really special. But chief of department, that was pretty cool. You know, it was I had wonderful people. I had a great staff. I had a great group of staff chiefs, talented, smart, young, many of them. I wound up coaxing Frank Leib to get involved in staff. He wound up going to the fire academy, and I just had a great group of people working for me, and they made my job easy.
And with that being said, what does leadership mean to you?
So here's what I think about leadership. Leadership is about people. It's about, you know, there's several different definitions of leadership. But the one that has always stuck with me goes back to the time when I was in first line supervisors training when I first got promoted to lieutenant. There was a battalion chief whose name was Bob Burns. He was teaching first line supervisors training program, all the new lieutenants. He was on a staff of people, but he was kind of the lead guy. And Bob was a leadership student. Like he really delved into leadership. And what I always remember what he said to us was, leadership is about the ability to influence people, right? So, but there's certain ways to go about it, or there's certain attributes that a good, successful leader can have. And this is what he said. And I'll never forget it. And I repeat it all the time. And I tell young officers and young chiefs, he said, leadership, people will follow leaders that are of good character, right? Have a good work ethic, that lead by example. But he said, in order to be able to influence people, you have to be a person of good character. And I always remembered that. And I'll add to that, I think to be a successful leader, you have to be able to communicate successfully, and be transparent. One of the things in the fire department of New York that's it's just a big it's a big organization. You know, we have 15,000 uniformed people. We have 11,000 fire officers and firefighters, 8,500 firefighters, 2,500 fire officers and chiefs, and we have 4,500 EMTs and paramedics. And then we have a civilian staff of about 2,000 people, you know, that are all support, that support operations. If you aren't a good communicator, if you don't communicate and you don't operate with transparency, I don't think you're going to be successful. That's just my personal opinion. So I always felt when I did become chief of department, even when I was chief of operations, I always said to myself, I don't want to be the guy that the members in the field are talking about. Oh, those idiots in headquarters, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. They have no idea what's going on out here, right? So I always said we have to stay in touch with the field. The boots on the ground are the most important people. Those are the people that do the work. We are here for them. And every day I went to work, and I tell people, every day you go to work, it's about the people that you work with and work that work for you, whether you're a lieutenant, a captain, a chief officer. But when you're the leader of the organization or the operations chief, every day you go to work has to be focused strictly on those folks that do the job, making sure that the citizens of the city of New York or whatever community you serve are getting the best possible service they can get. And you got to facilitate that. So we did a lot of communicating. You know, we went through COVID. We learned a lot through COVID about communication. Quite frankly, this this podcast, this Zoom mm-hmm. that we're doing right now,
mm-hmm.
we learned how to use it effectively during COVID. You know, we were doing Zoom. We used a platform called WebEx.
Okay.
We were using WebEx that we didn't know anything about. A couple of people in headquarters, a couple of really smart techie kind of people said, hey, we could use this platform to communicate with each other. But I said, how about we use this to communicate with the field? Everybody's got a computer in a firehouse. Everybody's got TVs hooked up to the computer in the kitchen. Let's communicate with the field that way. So we started to do WebEx conference calls or meetings with the field, on-duty people.
Mm-hmm.
We would do like a borough at a time. And, you know, if they got to run, they had to go, like the, whatever firehouse. But we were able to talk to the field directly from my office. That was one thing that really worked out well with COVID, and we continued to use it after the fact. The other thing we did, we would have staff meetings every week, every Thursday. 1 week was a meeting with the chief of department. Next week was a meeting with the fire commissioner, all the staff chiefs, fire and EMS staff. So it was about, you know, 25 people in a room, commissioner, chief of department, and everybody would give a report. So a lot of things get talked about in those meetings that the field needs to know. Like they
right.
need, there's some things that we can't share, but there
right.
are other things. Most things I think you can.
Right.
You know? So we started doing, somebody came up with a great idea, a young captain that worked for me in operations. His name was Mike Trascuzzi. He said, Chief, what about if we take the staff chiefs, the notes from the staff meetings and put it into a document? And call it like staff chief's notes or something like that. Operations note, whatever. I forget what we called it. Maybe staff chief's notes. And so he designed this page. It was beautiful. He made up, it was like a newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it by category, training, fire prevention, operations, EMS. And we shared information from the staff meetings. We did it in bullet form. Things that we could share with the field. As an example, people are always asking, when are they going to do more promotions? When are they promoting to lieutenant? When are they going to do promote? So we would talk about it in staff meetings. And when we had solid information that was accurate, we put it in the staff notes. So every 2 weeks, we would send out like a newsletter to the field via email and tell the troops, listen, here's what's going on in the job at our level. And this is what you need to be thinking about. The field loved it. This kid, Mike Trascuzzi, I said, you should get an administrative award for this idea. He did a great job. And so that we were communicating via WebEx. We were communicating via this newsletter. And then the last piece that I felt strongly about, and we learned this through COVID, there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of tension in the field during COVID. You know, a lot of people were getting sick. A lot of people were getting COVID. Our medical leave rate was sky high, like a lot of other places around the country. And I said, listen, man, we got to have the staff chiefs, the guy with stars in their collars. You got to be out in the firehouses talking to the troops in person. So we set up a schedule. Every staff chief got 4, 5, 6 battalions, and every battalion has anywhere from 5 to 10 companies. And I said, I want a staff chief in a firehouse. You guys got to visit every firehouse on your list and your battalions. And then after that, every day in New York City, after the day tour is over, we have what they call a citywide tour commander, and on the weekends. And that's a guy that's going to respond to third alarms or higher. So I said, I want somebody with stars in the firehouse every day. Visit a couple of firehouses. When you got citywide at night, visit at least one firehouse. If you could do two, that's awesome. So we were communicating personally with the WebEx. We were doing notes out to the field, and we had staff chiefs going to the firehouses on a regular basis. And the field, I think, really appreciated that. So in operations, that kind of worked for us. I thought communication was key. And going back to leadership, that is a key component of leadership. If you can communicate your leader's intent and do it clearly and make sure that they understand and let them ask questions too. With the WebEx calls, we used to send out ahead of time, listen, send us questions from the field that we can cover on the WebEx. If you have questions, we got some. We didn't get as many as I would have liked. But we did get some, and we used to try to address those questions on the WebExes as well. So the communication point, being a person of good character, being a person that's competent, a leader should be a person of good character and they're competent and they can communicate. That's my advice, and that's what I try to live up to. And I did it with great people surrounding me, helping me do that. And people with great ideas. A young captain came up with the idea for the staff notes. And I got calls from people that I knew in the field, firefighters, fire officers, chiefs. Man, this is unbelievable. You know, it used to be like a 2 or 3 page thing.
Right.
And it had all kinds of information that we were able to share. So I thought that was great. And then as chief of department, I said, you know what? Chief of department is, operations is very busy. It's just a on every day, just crazy. Every day is going on. Chief of department, you're the leader of your organization. So you're like a manager, a real manager, And you had bureau, you had four bureaus reporting to you: operations, fire prevention, training, EMS, and it was busy, but I had time. If it makes sense, I had time to spend to really get out in the field. And I said, I didn't want to be that guy, that chief of department, where people say, this guy doesn't know what's going on. So I kind of tried to build on what we did in operations as a team. And I said to my executive officer, who was a wonderful guy, one of my best friends on the job now, he's retired also. His name was Dave Morkel. He was a battalion chief. He was excellent, excellent, excellent executive officer. He made me look good. This guy was great. I said, Dave, and I used to tell my executive assistant, Dawn, I used to say, or Kerry, actually, when I was chief of department, I said, block out Fridays. Unless I got to go to something, the commissioner tells me I got to be there. Every Friday, most Fridays, I blanked my schedule and I went out in the morning. I went to an EMS station in the field and I rode on an ambulance with the EMTs and the paramedics. And I needed to learn more about EMS operations. Sadly or embarrassingly, I didn't know enough about it. We had a chief of EMS operations. She was excellent. Her name was Lillian Bonsignor. I worked with her when I was chief of fire operations. But I didn't know enough about EMS. I was an EMT for a long time, in the volunteers, but I needed to know more about the fire department operation, So I said, the only way I'm going to find out is if I go out and do it. So I went out. Every Friday morning, almost most Friday mornings, I went out. I rode on an ambulance with the folks, and I was able to talk to them and get feedback. What are the things that are really bothering you? The things, what do you want? It was awesome. The people, they were great. And in the afternoon, I would go to a firehouse. I would always go to firehouse because I knew I was going to get a good lunch. So I'd go to a firehouse, and I would ride. Usually with an engine company because the engines have four firefighters. There's an extra seat. We have some 5-man engine companies too. But I rode mostly in the 4-man. But I went to firehouses. I sat in the kitchen, took the questions. They were tough sometimes. The brothers and sisters could be rough. But I said, that's the only way I'm going to gain credibility here. I'm going out there. I'm riding on the rig. And one of my most favorite stories was I was at a firehouse one night, and when the chief of department is coming to the firehouse, the troops put out a spread like you wouldn't believe. So I'm in this firehouse in Brooklyn. It's an engine in a truck, and we get a run. So I get on the rig, and I'm sitting across from this young man who's the nozzle firefighter. He just got off probation, and he was a Marine, so I could see this kid's into it, man. He's all suited up. I had a sweatshirt on, and baseball cap or whatever. And it sounded pretty good. It sounded like it might be a job. So we're going, and I said, hey, you know how this works, right? He says, "What, chief?" I says, "When we get there, if it's a job, you stretch the line to the door and you give me the nozzle." And he says, "That's not happening, chief." That's what I wanted to hear, though. That's what I want to hear, like from a kid. He said, "That is not happening. It's my job, you know." So, but those are the experiences that I got when I went out in the field. So I did that for a good part of the time I was chief of department, and I loved every minute of it. And I think the field appreciated it, and that's why I kept on telling the guys, the staff chiefs, "You got to go out. You got to be out there with the troops, man. You got to listen to them, hear what's going on, man." So I had a great experience as chief of department. It was wonderful. Do all the ceremonial stuff. You go to promotions were great. The funerals are sad. Unfortunately, we had a lot of World Trade Center funerals when I was chief of department, as it continues today, to this day. I only had one line of duty death as chief of department. It was a young kid in Proby School. Vincent Malveaux was his name. He died in Proby School. He wound up having complications from that rhabdo. I forget the name, the medical term. Rhabdo, I forget what they call it, but he went down in Proby School and never regained consciousness. So he was a line of duty death. So that was very, very sad. His parents were, of course, devastated. It was their only child. Nice young man. And the worst day of my career is I had a line of duty death as a battalion chief when I was in the 3A battalion in Brooklyn. One of my lieutenants, his name was John Martinson, he died. Actually, January 3rd will be 16 years. It was January 3rd, 2008. He died at a fire in a high-rise residential building, the old Ebbets Field complex where the Brooklyn Dodgers used to play, is now a series of a complex of high-rise, 22, 25-story residential buildings. He died in a fire on the 14th floor there. So that was the worst day of my career, but I learned from it. I was a chief for about 8 years then, felt like I was on my game, but it was unfortunate, sad day. But it was worst day of my career. But when we talk about being humbled, that's the ultimate humility. You know what I mean? When you think you're on your game, you think you're pretty good at what you do, and then things happen. You know what I mean? Something happens like that. So, we beat ourselves up over that. But that's my story on leadership. Like I kind of gave you the keys to in my world, and learned a lot from that guy, Bob Burns.
And one of the things that makes it so much more powerful is the fact that I know and I've heard stories of chiefs that go through the ranks that become chief of department or they're high up there. And once you disconnect with the troops, once you forget what it's like, those are the departments that tend to suffer when it comes to morale and integrity and things of that nature. And I truly believe when you become a chief, yes, you're a chief officer, but you are still a firefighter and you should still remember what it's like.
Joe, our chief of department that was killed on 9/11, his name was Pete Gansey. He was one of the best chiefs that I worked for in my career, and we had several. I knew him pretty well. He was a battalion chief in the same firehouse where I was a lieutenant. Just a wonderful guy to begin with. He used to tell people, he used to say it at promotion ceremonies all the time. Well, he used to say, when people ask you what you did for a living, he'd say, "I was a New York City firefighter, and it doesn't get better than that." But he said, "I'm a New York City firefighter." And that's who we are. We're all firefighters. No matter how high you go in rank, you're a firefighter, just like everybody else. I was a chief in the volunteers too. Jeff, and I was a chief in Deer Park 2 times. And I learned a lot from my mistakes the first time when I did it the second time, and which was a 10-year span from the first time to the second time. And the same principles apply. It's actually, I tell people all the time, one of the toughest jobs I ever had in my life was being a chief in a volunteer outfit. Very difficult because you have people from all different walks of life, all different backgrounds, all different professions. White collar people, blue collar people, you got all kinds of different folks, and you got to try and bring these folks together. They're all there to serve their community. That was a tough job, but the same principles apply. If you're a person of good character, you're a competent person, you could communicate with people, I think you can be successful, but it's hard. It was very, very hard. I enjoyed the hell out of it. Actually, I enjoyed it a lot. And we're a small community, you know. We're transitioning. We have a fully paid EMS program now, you know, paramedics, ALS. We have some BLS folks too. We don't have any paid firefighters yet, but I think the direction that everybody's going on Long Island now, it's going to come. You know, very, very difficult to staff fire trucks, particularly during the day now. I'm sure you see it in your area, you know. So everybody's kind of transitioning. I think Mooresville, in fact, probably transitioned right over time, right? From a fully volunteer outfit to a combination department now, right?
It was volunteer, I'm pretty sure, and then it went like a part-time status, and then it full-time all the way, no volunteers, and that's just the way it is now.
It's that's and Long Island is a very unique area, man. You know, we have 2.5 million people live on Long Island. There's 181 fire departments. So Suffolk County, I live in Suffolk County. Suffolk County has 109 fire departments. I think 20 some are the ambulance corps, volunteer ambulance corps, but most of them are paying people now. And Nassau County has like 71 fire departments. It's 181 fire departments on Long Island. It's crazy. And there's only one department right now that has a fully paid engine company, Long Beach in Nassau County. They've had it for quite some time. And now out in eastern Long Island, a community called Setauket, they now have part-time firefighters during the day, during the week. They staff an engine company with four people, 5 in the morning to 5 at night. And it's meeting the needs in their community. But I think more and more departments are going to transition to that, you know, over time. I'm currently on the Board of Fire Commissioners in Deer Park. And I beat the drum a lot, and we're getting there. You know what I mean? It's going to be a matter of time before we start to do it, but we have to if we're going to serve our community properly.
Definitely. And along with that, what would you say the fire service is doing good at, and what can they improve on when it comes to recruitment and retention?
Yeah, that's a great question. My thought process is this, and this is just from my own experience where I live in my small area. I think we have more of a retention problem than we do a recruitment problem. We get people that come, we get people that join, we get people that come and get information to fill out an application. But once they see the requirements and the amount of time it's going to take away from their families, particularly, you know, if they're people with families, they shy away a lot of times, or they join and they don't last. They can't do it. They cannot make the commitment. But the other part of that, and this has been written about a lot in fire service trade magazines and others online and so on, the biggest problem with retention is poor leadership. And it's been written over and
That's a
over
fact.
and over again. So when you have poor leadership, you have that person that is not of a good character, that is not competent, right? Is all about themselves, can't communicate. People don't want to be in an organization like that. And that goes for any organization, honestly, other than fire departments, Knights of Columbus, Sons of Italy, the Masons, the Elks Lodge, all of them. If you have poor leadership, people don't want to be part of it. They don't want to come down and be miserable. You know what I mean? So I think in the fire service now, to be semi-successful, you got to be honest with people right up front. Now, there'll be people that make the argument in the volunteer circles in particular that we ask too much of the volunteers. This training, being trained to this standard is ridiculous. Say, hey, remember this, NFPA 1001 is a minimum standard. It's a minimum standard. I said, so going back to what we started with today, if you're going to be a student of the job, if you're going to be all in, you got it in your heart to want to do this job, well, then you'll do it if you really want to do it. But what we find today, I think a lot of people come in half-heartedly, not really understanding, like, this is a dangerous business. You can get killed doing this, right? Fire and EMS, right? It's a big commitment. So the only thing I could say to combat the issue is that we have to be honest with people, tell them this is what it requires. This is before they even put an application in. Listen, here's the story. You're going to have to be able to give us a minimum amount of time, but your training requirements are very, very important. You have to do it. If you want to ride a fire truck and you want to put an SCBA on and you want to operate a hose line, you got to be here to learn how to do that. You can't get around that. There's no way you're going to get around it. So, one of the other questions I remember seeing in your list of questions or one of the topics is this whole notion of, what matters more, how many years you're in the service, how much experience you have. So I think this is a key point too, and it relates to retention, it relates to recruitment as well. Experience. So what is experience? So I'm going to go back to my good old friend, my senior mentor, John Vigiano. He was a captain, and at the time I was a captain, we were working together one day in the same firehouse. He was working overtime in my firehouse in the ladder company. I was the captain of the engine company. And he did a drill. And he sat around a kitchen table and he says, "We're going to do a drill today." I said, "All right." So I'm all in. I'm all ears when it comes to him. He asked the question. He says, "What's your definition of experience in this job?" He asked every firefighter in the room, including me. So everybody went around the table and then he gave his definition. He said, "You know what I think experience is in the fire department?" He started to talk about the ladder company first. He said, "When you have had five butt-kicking fires in every position in the truck, can, irons, roof, outside vent, then I'll say you got some experience. When you've had five or six butt-kicking fires as the nozzle firefighter, then I'll say you got some experience." And the point he was making was, I don't care if you have 20 years on the job, 5 years in the job. Experience is doing it. Like, that's the only way you get the experience. That's why training is so important today. Live training, hands-on training, right? And listen, you got to do live training the right way. Unfortunately, we've had people get killed doing live fire training because it wasn't done the right way, maybe, right? But there's a way to do it right. So, as it relates to recruitment and retention, people got to understand the only way you get good at this is that you got to be here, you got to do it, you got to experience it, you got to do the job. And so here's the thing. Think about your department. I'll think about my volunteer department, even New York City Fire Department. If you go and you're in a department or you're in a company or a unit that's not very busy, that's just the way it is, right? You got assigned to that company, you join that volunteer outfit. That's just the way it is. You could have 20 years and have very little experience. You might have a lot of up here in your head. You might have trained a lot, but you really haven't had a lot of fires. So even in New York City, we have some companies that aren't that busy. Good companies, really good. They're into the job. They're students of the job. But to get experience, it takes a long time versus a busier outfit where they go to fires on a maybe a more frequent basis. They are able to gain experience in a shorter period of time. So I was very fortunate when I got on the job. I went to some busy companies as a firefighter, and I was able to learn pretty quickly, what it was all about. That's why I say in the volunteer service, like in my department, we have a great training program. We have some tremendous people do our training, but it takes a long time to get experience, right? And so that's the danger, right? So, you have an inexperienced crew, and they get that fire. They get that fire that, we all hope to get, like a really good job. Hopefully it goes well. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes none of them go 100%. So I think in recruitment and retention, we got to be honest with people. We got to explain to them in order to get experience, you got to be here. You got to participate. And that's hard in today's world, especially with people with families.
Right.
We just had a whole bunch of new young kids join. We got like 12 probies in the department right now. They're all 18, 19, 20 years old. They're great. That's how it was when I joined. I joined with a whole bunch of guys that I went to high school with. But how long are we going to keep them? They're going to go to college. Some of them are still in high school. They're graduating in June. They're going to firefighter one training. They did all of that. They're doing our training, our in-house training. They go out to the fire academy to get some experience there. We happen to have a burn building in Deer Park. We have our own training building. It's awesome. In fact, it was just dedicated to Jeff's dad and my dad, because they worked together years ago as chiefs, and they were all about training. So we have a beautiful building where we're able to do hands-on training as much as we can, and we got good people doing it. But it has its ups and downs, right? As
Right.
it right.
Right.
And got these young people, how long are we going to keep them? And listen, if we get 4 or 5 years out of them, that's awesome. Then they go to college or they fall in love, they move out of town, and next thing you know, we lose them. So we have a retention problem more than a recruitment problem, in my humble opinion.
Okay. And with that being said, you kind of hit on it already, but even to my amazement, we have individuals, whether career or volunteer, that don't believe training should be the forefront, that training is necessary with this job. How important is training to you?
Training is the cornerstone of everything we do as firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics. Listen, you could become an EMT and a paramedic. My son became a paramedic in New York City. He's waiting to become a firefighter. But if you don't use the paramedic skills and you're not doing ALS work, you're not going to be good at it. Just the way it is. EMT, same thing. Firefighter. So you have to practice more often. That's the whole key. Like, you have to train more, I would argue, when you're not doing as much work. You got to train more. So the folks that often say that we do too much training, I'm like, I don't know. Can you do too much training? I don't think that's a valid point. Now, training doesn't have to be all the time like intense,
Right,
Training
right.
can be sitting in the firehouse kitchen or sitting in the training room, throwing up a video on an incident somewhere around the country or in your own department, and just talking about it. Just talking about it. Talking to firefighters that do have experience. Maybe they had a bad experience. Let them talk about it. Sit down and chat with them. Say, hey, here's what happened to me. In New York City, in our battalion chief's training program, when you get promoted battalion chief, you go to school for 6 weeks before you could go to the field. Same thing with lieutenant, 6 weeks before you go to the field. We used to bring in chiefs that had bad incidents. I was one of them. I had a fatal fire.
Right.
And I would sit there with the chiefs in the room and talk about my fire, and say, here's what happened. Here's what I think I did pretty well. Here's what I think I dropped the ball. And people gain so much from that. So that could be a training thing. You don't have to always be suited up and doing it. Like, right? You could go to the apparatus, take a tool out, and just start talking about it. That's a training. That's a drill. So I don't think you could ever do too much training, quite frankly. I think you could balance the training.
Right.
Don't beat them up every other week and make them, in 90-degree weather, go out there and beat themselves up. But all right, so it's too hot to suit up today. Maybe go do a burn drill. All right, maybe let's just talk about engine operations. Let's talk about it. Let's throw up a couple of videos, a couple of pictures, a couple of buildings around town. And the other thing that's a great tool today, there's so many different ones now. All these fire simulation tools, on computer. You got Sims You Share is one that I'm aware of that we used in New York. Another one we were using was company called Digital Combustion Fire Studio.
Okay.
You could take pictures of buildings in your
Yep.
district, and you could build a fire
Yep.
in the room and talk about it. All right, you're the first new engine officer. What are you going to do? You got the nozzle. What are you thinking? You're the canned firefighter. What are you thinking? You got the irons. What are you? You're right. And or as a chief, I'm the incident commander. We use the fire simulations in our battalion chiefs program very successfully. We used to put chiefs up in the room. Said, you're the chief, get an aide, because in New York City we have chief's drivers, we call them aides, battalion firefighters, and you're going to run this fire. And we did communications with radios and the whole nine yards. You can build them out as detailed as you want, as complicated as you want, and you can keep them simple. So those are great training tools. Put a flyer on a wall, like I said, even a video.
Right.
So in my opinion, you can never do enough training, man. Training is the cornerstone of being successful, man. It's the only way you're going to be prepared. And this job, this business is all about preparation. You have to be prepared because when you turn the corner, and it's blowing out the windows, or somebody's screaming, my kid's in there. You better be ready, man. You better be on your game. Volunteer, career, doesn't matter. Fires are the same. The fires are fire. So you got to be prepared. So, you got to be on your game. You got to be that student of the job.
Well said. Well said. I always like to ask the guests at the end, where would you like to see yourself? But since you have pretty much climbed through the ranks in your wildest dreams, you never imagined that you'd get to chief of department. Well, with that being said, what's next for you?
So, I've been out of the job now about a year and a half. I got involved in doing a little work now with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. I'm like the liaison to the FDNY. So it's not a really hard job. It's a communication job. It's a connection job, and I'm really enjoying that. We're working on a couple of different projects, and that's going well. I'm doing a couple of lectures here and there, but I don't want to be too busy. I have
Gotcha.
five grandchildren now.
Gotcha.
My kids live pretty close, and so I hate to say, like, sometimes I'm a little picky and choosy. I'm doing something for FASNY, Firefighters Association of State of New York, and I'm going to do something in Philadelphia area in March. I'm going to do a class there, but I pick and choose, man. I don't want to be. I could be busy if I wanted to.
Right.
Like Frank Lieb, he's all over the world, for crying out loud. He's everywhere. He wrote a
Right.
book. I think he wrote another book with Billy Goldfeder. I wish, I always wanted to write a book. I'm just lazy. I'm retired. Like I said, I did 42 years in the FDNY. I tell you what, man, I thought I worked very hard. And now I feel like I'm 65 years old. I want to relax. I don't know how much time I got left on this earth. I want to watch my grandchildren grow up. They're all very young. And so, I want to contribute. I'm on the board of fire commissioners in Deer Park. I don't really respond much anymore, but I try to offer, I'll call it wisdom, maybe some wisdom, you know what I mean?
Gotcha.
Some leadership tips,
Right.
and just impress upon people how important it is to train. So that's kind of where I see myself more in a mentoring capacity now. That's how I kind of
Understood.
see it. And I'm looking forward. I'm hoping my son is going to be in this class in January. It looks pretty good. And watch him have a hopefully an awesome career. I'll be very proud of him. And my nephew's going to graduate Proby School in a couple of weeks. So to watch these young people now come into the job, they're the next generation. You're the next generation. You're a young guy. It's people like you that make this the greatest job on earth, man. You could tell. I could see it in your face. I could see it in your eyes how much you love it. And I'm looking at all the paraphernalia behind you on your bookshelf. This is the greatest job on earth, man. It's as dangerous as it is. There's nothing better than service. Nothing better than taking care of people, man. So, however you do it, as a volunteer, as a career firefighter, there's nothing better. I think we were all put on this earth to serve in some way, shape, or form, whatever it is you do. Doesn't have to be the fire service, whatever it is.
Right.
But there's nothing better than that. And that's all I try to give that message when I talk to people.
And what I also like the fact that you're also prioritizing a balance, fire and family, because you've had a outstanding established career within the FDNY, but all of it wouldn't be worth it if you couldn't have a family to come home to.
That's the truth. And I haven't always done that. And I'll be the first to admit it, man, because I was all in. Especially as a volunteer fire chief, I was out the door all the time. My wife, man, what she put up with, we're married 42 years. She was with me when I got on the job. We were going out, I met her when I was 19 years old. I said, so she put up with a lot, and our families put up with a lot, and we often take that for granted.
Absolutely.
And we shouldn't, and I did, and but to this day now it's time to give back a little bit to her and my family. And I still find it difficult at times, because I want to be part of something. And my wife is just unbelievable, man. If you don't have the support at home, you can't be into it. You can't be into the job as much. if you don't have the support at home. And that's the truth. And I worked with people over the years, and I've seen people in the volunteer business that maybe didn't have the support at home, and they weren't able to give it all. Like, you know what I mean? And this is the kind of job, man, you got to give it all. So yeah, to figure out the balance is very, very difficult for those of us that love it as much. Like, right?
Exactly. Yes,
And
sir.
but you got to try. You know, I tried. My wife picked up the slack though, man, and that's what made it work. You know, she really did. She did it with the
Absolutely.
kids, and my wife worked. She was a teacher, and she did it all, man. And so I give her all the credit, man. She was great.
Now, the spouses are what I call the spouses are the slack man on the line. I mean, the Nozzleman always gets the credit, but it's always the slack person that's feeding you that line, making it go seamlessly.
That's
And to
correct.
me, that's what the spouses of anybody that's in this job, whether fire, police, EMS, if you truly care for it, you're gonna be out. You're gonna be out training. You're gonna miss things, but they hold it down while we're gone.
There's a lot more going on today. If you go to the fire conferences, there's a lot more attention being given to training the spouses to understand what their husbands or wives are going through in this business. A lot more being written about it. People have published books about it. I've been to several conferences where I sat in on sessions where that's something that we always took for granted. And now I think a lot of fire departments, paid and volunteer, are doing a better job of educating the spouse, the girlfriends, the significant others on what this is really about. And this is the real deal, and we're here to help you. So I think that's becoming more and more prevalent in the business, and it should. And I think that that's part of the recruit, that's part of the retention problem, I think.
Right.
Not being able, not educating the spouse on what the business is all about and what it's really going to take, what the commitment is. I think that's a big part of the retention problem these days.
Definitely. Definitely. Chief, I really appreciate you spending the time out of your day to do this. I'm gonna give a shout out to Jeff Sickles. Thank you, man. He was like, "Hey, I got a guy for you. I think you'd really enjoy it." And he was the one that made this happen. So Jeff, thank you for truly making this. This was a great interview. Tom, Chief, I appreciate you coming on and spreading the good word.
No, man, I'm sorry it took so long to make the connection, but I'm glad we did. Really, really a pleasure to meet you. And maybe we'll meet in the future at a conference or something like, you know. And if I could ever do anything else for you, let me know. Thank
Yes,
you.
sir. Will do. Thank you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.